Hey gang, we're rolling out a new season of the podcast and have a great lineup of guests thus far. The first of which is going to be discussing a topic that I'm going to gather. The last time that he was on the podcast was probably about a year and a half ago. I'm going to gather 20 to 30% of you at most were thinking about this particular topic in terms of being top of mind. Fast forward a mere year and a half, and I'm going to gather that perhaps 99% of you have this topic top of mind, and it is none other than artificial intelligence. And how can you leverage it? What does it mean to use AI within the enterprise? What are practical use cases, et cetera, et cetera? So I'm super excited to have Barak back to have a conversation. The last time we spoke, he was head of product at Google Languages AI. So he was running all their AI language effort and that team. He's now an executive in residence at Scale Venture Partners. And there are execs in residence and there are entrepreneurs in residence at funds. An executive in residence sits with the fund partners and helps them vet the various startups that are pitching the fund, whereas the entrepreneurs in residence, they're generally just sitting within the fund trying to create a startup from within the fund. So they're not really concerned with helping the fund partners vet the various other startups that are pitching the fund. So wanted to make that distinction because Barak comes from such a good background of enterprise corporate space. And so he's sitting at that fund now helping them figure out, hey, like what are the right opportunities out there? So with that as a bit of a backdrop, I'm going to quickly tell you a little bit about his background and what we cover. And we do cover a ton of ground, like starting with how society is currently absorbing, if you will, the AI wave. And then we move into the most promising advancements within AI from the view of both investors as well as enterprises. We also hit a bit on why language matters in the overall AI conversation. In fact, it's probably the only thing that matters. We also discuss specific AI use cases for businesses that are actionable, practical, pragmatic. We discuss why process skills and tools, quote unquote, process skills and tools will probably be the three main focal points for use cases with AI. So keep that in mind as you're talking to your teams. We also dig into AI mapping as it relates to the knowledge level of an enterprise customer. So how do you map your AI tool set to the knowledge level of your customers? Pretty interesting there. We discuss risks with AI as it relates to privacy, security, and bias in data, as well as ethics. And we hit on how to navigate use cases for your specific industry and why probably AI in customer service is likely the place for you to start. And I'll give a little hint here that productivity isn't necessarily the measurement stick. And we hit on a bunch of other topics within AI, ranging from using AI as a co-pilot within your company's workflows. We talk about ChatGPT-4, sensing human emotions. If just think about that sentence, ChatGPT-4, sensing human emotions, there's so much wrapped up in that. We talk about software development use cases and a whole lot more as well. And aside from his current role at Scale Ventures, we spoke a little bit about Barak's background at Google, where he was basically running the teams there on the languages front as well as the translate teams. He had a specific focus on applying cutting-edge AI and machine learning technologies to deliver experiences across the Google Search, Assistant, Cloud, Chrome Ads, and various other products over there. Prior to joining Google in 2011, Barak was Director of Product in Microsoft's mobile advertising team. So he's got the Microsoft side, and he's got the Google side. Real interesting. And was also Head of Mobile Commerce at PayPal. So he's got the B2C experience there, and was a chief technical officer at a startup in Israel. And quite interestingly, he lived for more than 10 years in Russia and Israel, and then of course moved over to the US and speaks three languages fluently. He earned his Bachelor's of Law from Tel Aviv University and a Master's of Business from the University of California at Berkeley. And you'll also see some of his recent works in the podcast notes, so have a look there as well. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I had an absolute blast taping it. He's probably three or four levels above my knowledge skill set, and he was able to bring it right down to my level. So I'm figuring you're going to have no problems hearing and learning from him as well. Enjoy.
The Bob Johnston Podcast.
Barak Tarovsky, thanks so much for joining the podcast. It has been a while. You are a repeat offender. This is your second turn here on the podcast. And boy, a lot has changed since we last spoke. And maybe it's only been a year and a half at most, but the world of AI has been booming. There's no shortage of controversy, or maybe that's not even the right word. There's no shortage of innovation, let's say, within the space. There's a ton of press. I mean, even this week we read that IBM is planning to permanently remove some positions because they feel that those roles will be better covered with artificial intelligence. There's just a ton of other press that's out there. What, just to level set the conversation here, we want to jump into use cases in the enterprise, obviously, within the business world, because that's what's on a lot of people's minds. But just to level set from the society perspective, the societal perspective, you know, where are we right now from your perspective? And you've got a lot of experience in this space in the early days, you know, at Google and so forth. I'd love to get, like, even just the past 6 months or so, like, where are we in terms of scale from where we were, let's say, in 2015?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for having me here for the second time. And you're right, it's very exciting times. I always wish to myself, may you live in exciting times. And I feel we do live in very exciting and maybe to some people rapidly changing and scary period of, I would say, even of human history, because I call it the second coming of AI, because we basically have a new incarnation of this disruptive technology. And, you know, some people like Sundar, CEO Sundar Pichai, compares AI to the invention of electricity and fire, because it will impact every aspect of our lives. I personally consider myself particularly lucky to have both worked on the first major AI breakthrough that happened in 2016 when Google launched the first product, Google Translate, the product I had a pleasure to leading on the product side. That was the first ever product that used deep neural networks, what we now call AI or large language models, at enormous scale. But at that time, since between 2016 and 2022, 2023, a lot of the disruption was limited to big tech companies that used AI at scale in multiple places, like at Google. We use it to better understand queries. We used it to better target queries to ads, to better translate things, etc. But it was very limited to big tech. Now we basically have this new generation of AI tools, and to some extent they were, you know, the explosion happened because OpenAI not only developed the model but based on some of the technology that Google published and developed, but also put a very nice UI around it. And now we can see that those AI technologies can produce natural human-like outputs for many topics. And, you know, it's extremely exciting because I believe it will democratize the use cases of AI. As you can imagine, with every new and disruptive technology, even think about early days of railroads or planes, or et cetera, productizing and monetizing those groundbreaking AI technology is both exciting and scary, full of complexity and nuances required to, you know, to cross the chasm. And I think I'm very excited to think about it, to write, to publish about it, and talk about it at your podcast.
Yeah, there's really been a lot happening, and I appreciate you, you know, providing just a little bit of background on sort of where you see we are right now, anyway, within your peer group, you know, in Silicon Valley, let's call it, you know, or more broadly even, within your peer group, and it could be at the venture fund you're at now, or it could be from, you know, your days at Google, or maybe within, you know, the world of startups, what are the most promising advancements you are seeing? And perhaps in this case, you may be able to speak specifically or maybe a little more generally, which is okay too. I'm just curious from that perspective, the people that are on the inside of this, right? Like the early folks that are helping to move this forward, what are they seeing? What are they saying? What are they experiencing?
Yeah, so I basically published a framework that people could find on my LinkedIn profile called a framework for evaluating generative AI use cases. And that was after discussing with many folks that were early practitioners of this technology like me. And I believe one relatively general agreement is that it's very important to separate the breakthrough in fluency. And what I mean by fluency is that now the technology, this large language model technology, is very good in producing human-like, smooth, confident output, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it could be highly accurate. It's accurate most of the times, but not always accurate, and could be subject to what I call hallucinations. So I think when I suggest everyone, both my colleagues, but also everyone in the industry or people who want to adopt this technology, to look at every use cases from a perspective of, to some extent, two axes. Is the use case that you're trying to use large language models or generative AI, is the use case requires high accuracy or low accuracy, and are the use case require high fluency or low fluency? So let's just give you an example to make it real. Let's say the use case is to generate new music or generate new image for marketing or sales purposes, or create a new children's book, so new science fiction, or write a review. I would argue that what you need the most is a high fluency. You need a good story. In some extreme cases, you don't even need accuracy at all. It's like a made-up, science fiction story, or there is no right or wrong answer. In those cases, you basically need a good story. If you go to the other extreme, and let's say you make, a Google or Bing search, and you want to use the data, the query response, as an input for a very important personal or business decision, let's say decisions that involve time or money or both, then you're talking about mostly high accuracy. That's the most important thing. Yes, some explanation about it is probably very helpful, but if it's inaccurate, it's a pretty big deal. So those are two axes that I encourage everyone to look.
Interesting.
And the third axis is, whether, I call it high-low, whether it's a high or low stakes. And what I mean by that is that what is the risk and what are the consequences if you get the response wrong, meaning if the response is very fluent but inaccurate. And one way to look at it is whether the use case could rely more on what I call human labeling or correction at scale. For example, users could use generative AI to compose a draft of a document or an email or a presentation, or even a customer service chat. We'll likely review the draft output and adjust, correct it for accuracy, meaning the division of work between the generative AI, the machine, and the human would be: you, generative AI, be responsible for fluency, because eloquent writing or eloquent speech is difficult for many people and it requires more time, right? And human will be responsible to occasionally correcting the factual mistakes. And the beauty of this approach is that it will not only make the generative AI system better, because your kind of user feedback will further improve the model, but could still introduce a pretty significant 50 to 70% productivity boost that you would be willing to, even, on the monetization potential, willing be to pay a premium. If now, somebody who is writing a business email can cut 50 to 70% of the time because that takes a lot of effort for him, that's great. And this, this AI plus human augmentation and division of duties, AI will be responsible for fluence, smooth story, and one human will be responsible for validating, right? I'm sure there is also additional use cases that offers us good balance and also can offer monetization potential and also this manageable complexity. But I would say that use cases that are, let's call it low to medium stakes, meaning users could actually correct it before they send it, would be probably the most practical application in the short to medium term, because the relative strengths of LLMs on the fluency side.
I've got a lot of questions. First is when you, and by the way, I've got a use case as well that I'd like to share with you. When you said the word hallucination, did you mean delusional? People, you know, people are going to go off on the wrong track and they're not going to be thinking about your three axes or your two axes?
Hallucination is a scientific term. Let me try to explain it in human terms. I think part of the challenge that we don't encounter this behavior that somebody who is extremely fluent and confident and smooth in his talk, like an adult, but his conscience to some extent is of a seven-year-old child, meaning he cannot really distinguish right or wrong, what's applicable, what's not applicable. If you think about those models, they are trained to produce an answer, even if answer doesn't make sense, right? So that's part of the challenge that, you know, that where hallucination could come. It could really make up an answer because from his perspective, he's trained to provide an answer. Let me give you an interesting example from my Translate world. In Translate, in 2020 and 2019, we wanted to deal with some of the gender bias issues that they have in Translate models because our training data, to some extent, picks societal biases that are happening in language. For example, you know, in training data, you can have professions, for example. There are languages in our world that are gender ambiguous, meaning it could be he's a doctor, she's a doctor. Like in Turkish, Ober doctor could be either, and you understand it by context. But our models don't know that. They look on frequency of occasion where you say doctor is a female, doctor male, right? And what can you do if male profession of doctor exists for thousands of years and female started to practice, you know, medicine 150 years? So you basically get all those issues. He is a doctor, she is a secretary. He is an engineer, she is a babysitter. So we wanted to deal with it, and we wanted to create female and male variants of the same. So he's a doctor, she's a doctor, to make it easier for people to choose and not to reinforce those biases. Guess what? It sounded easy for a human, but it required us to create three different AI models to deal with it. The first AI model was to actually identify what phrases actually are gender agnostic, because not everything. The second one was actually to train a model to generate an answer that will have female and male variants. Think about like LLMs, right? And the third one, we actually had to create a model to ground it and correct hallucinations. And let me give an example of what hallucination could mean. Remember, the model of creating female and male variants, the model says just create male and female variants, whether it makes sense or not. So an example would be, would you marry me, which has no gender, right? So to create female and male variant, it will change the meaning and say, will you marry her? Will you marry him? And my personal favorite example was value-added tax. Has no gender and should not have a gender. Well, the model is saying female and male variants. Her value-added tax, his value-added tax. So that's, to me, like an extreme example of sometimes hallucination because the model says, I need to produce
an answer. So that's your technology hallucination.
Yes.
You know, I'm thinking about your axes, and I wonder, from both the investor perspective, from an institutional investor, let's call it a seed or series A venture fund, and then also from a corporate perspective, let's say you're a United Health or a Coca-Cola, or Adidas, and you're trying to figure out a use case. Like, is the investment community starting to slice their investments based on these axes? And in the enterprise world, are they looking at use cases based on that? Or is this just more of your theoretical axis, if you will?
I believe that companies are starting to look at that. I mean, I will give you a couple of examples, and we recently saw it. So just like the way I encourage everyone to think, and I think people, investors are starting to think about it this way, and also enterprises, when you're prioritizing different use cases according to those use cases, I think the critical question would be, which of those use cases A, offer large monetization potential, because it's still non-trivial and expensive undertaking to use large language models, and B, offers realistic implementation potential, meaning generative AI technology is mature enough for users or enterprise to adopt it at scale for those use cases. And I do believe there are several use cases that provide a sweet spot of sizable monetization potential and practical implementation using generative AI. in short to medium terms. I'll give you a couple of examples, and one of them is actually now very much in the news. The first, the biggest one in my opinion, is customer-facing interactions, because LLMs can greatly improve productivity and, most importantly, customer experience of those interactions. I'm talking about sales, I'm talking about service, you know, via email, chat, and even calls, like what Google Duplex does. And that literally spans more or less every industry. It could be financial services, it could be healthcare, it could be utilities, it could be transportation. Many industries at large scale spending billions of dollars on customer service, and it could be both improving productivity and greatly improving customer experience. I will expand on that. The second topic that I think is very much top of mind is software development. Early studies show that more than 50% increase in productivity, and by the way, also higher performance and satisfaction among developers when you have like AI-assisted coding, like, you know, GitHub Copilot. And finally, the example that recently in the news is education. As you probably saw, ChatGPT, especially the most recent version, it can pass nursing, law bar, economics, etc., a bunch of SAT tests, right? I believe it will unleash a new era of innovation of using AI to make teaching easier and more impactful, as well as how we learn necessary skills for the rapidly changing workplace of the future. That said, I don't know if you noticed, companies like Chegg or Pearson and others got Chegg dropped like 50% because they basically notified Wall Street that, you know, they're adversely impacted right now by ChatGPT. So I think it's coming, and in some industries much faster than to others.
On the education piece, you know, I just read an article this morning, and I think it was the New York Times, that made the case that, in fact, you know, despite the current sort of negativity around, you know, the use of AI because it can write papers and essays for kids rather than them writing themselves, that in fact, long term, the use case of AI could be a wonderful, if not a benefit, then at least, you know, an enhancement to how a student learns. Do you think that's the case, or is a jury out still on this?
I believe that, first of all, we will experience, and it's kind of related to your point about the workplace changes with AI. Again, I generally believe that in the long term, every technological advancement in generally increasing number of jobs, not decreasing them, but that's in the long term. For example, Goldman Sachs had a research that 60% of jobs we have today didn't exist in the 1940s. So technological advancement not only create wealth, more wealth, but also increase employment. However, it requires change in skills, and some professions will become less important or more obsolete, and you need to change and develop new skills. I believe that AI in education can really unleash this new era of innovation on using AI making teaching easier and more impactful, especially how we learn new necessary skill for this rapidly changing workplace of the future.
100%. Yep. That makes good sense to me. You know, we did a webinar a couple of weeks ago through our membership platform, which is called exec.org. And we had the head of AI and data for United Health as a speaker. And he felt the way to look at, you know, artificial intelligence is that it should be a co-pilot, in that, like, yes, it seeks to create intelligent machines that replicate human behavior, quote unquote, but it's also more about, you know, the integration and tuning of AI into the workflows of a company. And I really liked the way that he worded that. And he gave a very simple but precise use case that they're using now at United Health, which is around customer service letter writing. So I guess apparently, like, once a customer service rep at United Health gets off the phone with the patient, there's all kinds of notes they've got to take. They've got to write it all up, right? And so I guess the ability to leverage AI to help in that process is really interesting, and it can reduce a ton of effort, right? like on the part of these employees. Mm-hmm. And you still need those employees to be able to guide the AI and to sort of sit on the phone with the patients, of course, but that piece of their heavy work can be handled by AI. And I love that use case, super simple, but I mean, you think that that could be applied to so many other industries out there that have lots of call centers, lots of customer service reps, right? And they have these mundane tasks that are rote and monotonous and take a ton of time. You know, the ability to just have the machine handle those tasks is a fantastic use case.
Absolutely. And actually, I want to double click on it. First of all, I could not agree more. I generally believe AI is a co-pilot or enhancer of human skills. And I really like the quote from Steve Jobs, who was talking about technology in general. He basically said, look, if you put all the animals and rank them how fast they run, human beings will be, you know, somewhere below average. I mean, they're faster than a turtle, but way slower than a cheetah. However, human on a bicycle, human on a car will be way faster than cheetah. And that's how I believe technology, AI included, should be looked at. It enhances human skills, complements user skills. But I actually think, to your point about use case of generative AI in customer-facing interactions, that, in my opinion, will be one of the best use cases, because I believe that this technology is well-positioned to disrupt. I actually think it's broader than the use case that United Health gave. It's a good starting use case, but I think it's way more than that. And let me expand on that. I believe that it will really disrupt how enterprises handle customer interaction across. And I'm talking about sales and marketing and customer service. And you added another one, let's call it post-service maybe, across all channels, emails, documents, chats, even calls, like think Google Duplex, right? And doesn't have to be fully automated, as you said. It could be a writing aid. It could be a tool to help. But what I mean is that, it will impact almost every industry. If healthcare is probably one of the industries, as you probably know, because of regulations and privacy and HIPAA, and what you have it might also be impacted by industry dynamics, not only technology. But like there's a ton of other verticals that we could start faster. But what I wanted to emphasize is that in addition to significant productivity improvements, meaning reducing costs, I believe that companies that embrace generative AI will also offer superior customer service or customer experience, because A, you could suggest to human or even do it automatically, you could offer much richer and fluent customer interactions, because ChatGPT-based customer interactions can sound much more human and knowledgeable than sales or customer service rep, because of the fluency and ability to rephrase any response, right, versus repeating one-size-fits-all cookie cutter, in many cases, not greatly worded knowledge-based articles. You can also make it, to some extent, personalized, at least for the group. You could say, make it non-technical answer, make it like a five-year-old answer, make it very professionally sounded technical answer. The ChatGPT ability to generate human quality responses is really critical to overcome. We have the syndrome of operator when people, you know, many customers quickly become annoyed by robotic responses of both current automated tools, but also by how even, you know, offshore customer service talks, because in many cases it's cookie cutter response. That's one angle. The second angle is also it can generate dramatically faster response times, right? You can generate sales, initial outreach or follow-up responses in customer service emails, chat, speech, content in seconds versus minutes, hours, days, greatly improving productivity and user experience of customer-facing interactions, which have much less wait time. So I think I encourage every vertical, especially customer-facing interactions, not only think about it as cost-cutting measure, which I think will have some impact on productivity improvement, no doubt about it, but also look at that as an ability to greatly improve customer experience.
That is a more of an advanced and tighter kind of use case around the use of language. I like that a lot. And it's almost like you can apply AI or the AI can effectively map and mirror to whatever the language is, or let's call it the knowledge level of the patient or the customer.
Yeah. And by the way, I forgot to mention one additional thing, that LLM is, especially ChatGPT-4, is really good and actually sense human emotions, believe it or not, even from text. And there was actually early research from Stanford that measured the impact and productivity gain on actually relatively low-level customer service reps. And what they found it's a pretty significant gain in customer experience and productivity, because to some extent, it makes every average sales rep basically tap the knowledge of the best sales reps. So believe it or not, well, it actually makes sense. The best customer service reps, they literally have spreadsheets of responses for different use cases based on customer mood. For example, when customer is upset, they have, from their experience, the basic right type of phrases that work well to calm customers down. If they need to upsell, cross-sell a product, they have really good phrases to do that. But that's only very good, open-minded sales reps do that. Most of average sales reps do it less. So imagine yourself now, the system based on the sentiment or the sense of even your voice, or at least the text, could suggest you much better human-like, even empathetic responses. In addition to, you know, the language, it also could be tone and how you respond for different situations. That's also a big deal.
Yeah. Is there any competitive advantage ultimately with AI? What I mean is, if every enterprise out there has access to the tool, it's, mm-hmm. you know, is it any different than if we all have access to Microsoft Word or Excel? We all are using it. We don't have any kind of competitive advantage with Word or Excel.
Great question.
Or is it like, you know, how the enterprise gets super savvy in terms, you know, of the inputs, I guess, with AI, right? Like if inputs are really savvy, then maybe they're going to get a competitive advantage.
Right. Well, two things. Let's talk about how you can leverage AI to gain a competitive advantage. And then the second question that you ask is like, what are the strategies you should deploy as an enterprise to use AI effectively? Those are two connected questions. So let me start with leveraging AI for competitive advantage. First of all, there is still a big discussion whether the future will be those large, what I call foundational generic model a la ChatGPT that gets a lot of traction in many industries like this, passing law exam and passing other exams. That's pretty amazing, right? But generally speaking, if you look at the enterprise, you basically have two types of competitive advantage. The first one is kind of some kind of a moat that is defensible over time. It could be brand, could be, you know, intellectual property. It could be better institutions than others to get to scale. The second example could be first mover advantage. You basically try to launch something new and lock market share, but probably it's less defensible if everybody else has access to, you know, let's say this technology. You theoretically can leverage AI to do both. If you have defensible assets, let's say data that is specific and is very valuable, you could basically use this data to develop new, more exciting applications or adding future features to your existing application while reducing cost. Right? On the flip side, you also could be, because of the size and speed of impact, I think there is a value of being fast and nimble, because it allows smart first movers to potentially get to scale fast. And I don't know if it's a lockout competition, but at least get a pretty significant lead on competition, which is a classical enterprise, you know, brand, better integration with the better understanding of the process of the enterprise, better execution, etc. Both cases are very relevant. My feeling is that, like in every, you know, technological advantage, initially it's a technology, but at the end of the day, it's much more. Microsoft shows that in the 80s and 90s, they were not the first. They even were not the best in some of the topics, but they were executing well. They really focused. They developed a brand, that's an IP in some areas, and they did it well. So I think it's very important to look at this from both perspectives and be practical about it.
We should try to circle back for a second on the investment thesis, but in terms of the corporate case, you know, or the enterprise case, what else are you seeing that's really interesting? Are there one or two examples that, you know, that kind of
As I said, I believe, yes, customer service interaction, in my opinion, is absolutely a huge use case. I'll probably be publishing something about that. The second topic is software development. We didn't touch it, but I think it's a very interesting topic because you're effectively using large language models or non-human language, which theoretically should be easier because, you know, non-human language is much more structured. Unlike human language, that is basically, you know, has things like rules and exceptions to the rules and exceptions to the exemptions, etc. I also mentioned education. One additional thing that I think is coming is that you see a lot of data points that companies that effectively sit on data, even if the data is common domain, and it's being used to train those LLMs, starting saying we will start charging for access. So Reddit said they will start charging for access. Stack Overflow started saying they will be charging for access for coding training data. A bunch of entertainment folks started to either ban or saying, look, suing like Stability AI, Getty Images suing Stability AI because they basically use their their data as a training corpus without proper commercial license. There's some discussion in entertainment, some people like Grimes saying, oh, you can use my voice for 50% royalties. Then somebody created a fake Drake song and it was immediately removed by all the platforms because of the, you know. There's a ton of stuff, and I think that's one additional pretty nuanced approach. What is the future of training data sets? How accessible they will be? What is the business model to train, et cetera? So that's another very fascinating topic.
You know, the Drake thing I had heard, and I was listening to, I think it was to the Joe Rogan podcast, one of these other podcasts where they had heard that it was Drake's people that actually created that, you know, the deep fake Drake, just to see what kind of buzz, you know, they might be able to get out of that. But,
well,
but
it is interesting. Buzz.
Yeah. So,
Well, if it would be Drake, I mean, why would they remove it? But again, let's put it aside.
Right. To the investment thesis, right? Like if I'm an investor hanging out, you know, I'm sitting up in Silicon Valley and I'm, you know, New York or wherever, and I'm looking for some interesting seed stage, you know, startups within the space, like how the heck do you vet? Like, what does your nose say if you're an investor trying to vet an early stage startup in this space? Because they are popping up daily now.
All right. Well, there is a lot of hype and noise. And by the way, I don't think it's that different on investment stage or enterprise stage. There is a bunch of seed companies that are doing it every day. There is some new use case like, you know, Bloomberg developing Bloomberg GPT, Slack/Salesforce just launched Slack GPT, et cetera, et cetera. I would actually want to expand and say, what are the strategies to use AI effectively? And I think it's applicable to what investments you make, either internally or externally, which companies you either invest in or which company you partner. So I think it's very, very important to look at the business, either your business or as an investor, the business you want to focus or use case you want to focus in a very disciplined manner and find set of tasks. For example, customer facing tasks, which I'm a big believer, but also internal, that are definable enough that you can either completely automate. And by the way, as I said, my feeling is that if they're completely automatable today, they should have been automated by now. Or more importantly, probably augment humans to reduce cost and improve customer experience, right? This will drive what processes to focus on, what model would do it, and what model wouldn't do it. And I think it's important as an investment thesis and as enterprise implementation thesis. I will give an example on a relative basis. Translation example that I gave you before. We did translation of 100 languages, and we saw a huge improvement on all of them. But on the flip side, we saw that languages that already were in decent quality because they had a lot of training data in the old model, they improved by a lot, but incrementally, while languages like Indian languages that didn't have a lot of training data improved by a huge amount, like 3-4x improvement. So I think it's very important to understand also like what use cases will give you the biggest improvement, so to speak, and give you more bang for your buck, so to speak, both as investment thesis, et cetera. I also wanted to warn that it's more art than science. It sounds very logical, but there will be a lot of trial and error. Just to give you a funny anecdote from my translate date, back to the point of improving languages, there's not a lot of training data. We decided to created a multilingual model to improve a bunch of Indian languages. And one of the languages that we wanted to improve was called Kannada, with K, not Canada, Kannada. It's 80 million speaker, horrible quality before we had neural networks, because the data, there was not enough data. So we decided to mix multiple languages, like what ChatGPT does today. You mix multiple training data and you can talk about a lot of topics. And, you know, we discovered that we started to test before launching it. Initially, results were amazing when we used like automatic testing. But then before we launched it, we basically do a quality check of asking Kannada speakers, Kannada and English speakers to look at it. And they told us something interesting. They said, you know what, it didn't improve at all. And by the way, your previous translation and new translation are identical. So we started to look at that, and we figured out that a researcher who trained the model mixed up the languages accidentally because of like abbreviation of languages. Instead of mixing bunch of Indian languages with Canada, he mixed bunch of Indian languages with Georgia. As you can imagine, Georgian has nothing to do with Indic languages. But because there was not enough training data on Georgian as well, mixing it with Indian languages improved so much that we actually launched it. And then we realized that it actually does not matter. It's relatively random. You basically take a language with a lot of training data and mix a model with a language that does not have a lot of training data, and they all improve. For example, we took Polish, a lot of training data, and mixed it with Thai and Vietnamese, not a lot of training data, and they improved a lot. There will be a lot of this trial and error to see how it could work. And I think it's really, really important to focus on defining the tasks. What is kind of how you can, what is the variability of different answers? Can it be managed by some knowledge base that you already have? One way to look at that is that, like, how you, and actually, one additional thing that I wanted to say is that a big chunk of the time and effort of white-collar industry and function is spent on small error correction or simple query resolutions. Like, for example, you know, am I as a American Airlines customer eligible for refund for a specific use case, right? Or what I call simple variant generation of different type of content. The example that you gave me with United Health, that you need to create a follow-up notes or, you know, a customer email, etc. Instead of focusing on any high-level synthesis of this information and productive follow-up actions. So LLMs are in very early days in transforming those efforts and those functions to a point where potentially smaller number of higher-skilled people, people operators, deliver much higher quality and likely lower cost experience to their customer partners. So that's where I see a lot of potential opportunity is. But I also want to make sure that people understand that if you, as an executive or as an investor, focus on embracing generative AI for different needs, you should be aware that this technology requires new approaches to skills your employees need, as well as the new tools to make AI-assisted customer or back-office interaction more effective. It's not new offshoring phenomenon where you just reduce cost. You need different people, you need different skills and different tools. So it's very important to define those processes, skills, and tools.
That makes sense. And so, you know, So two questions just to follow up. If I'm sitting in the shoes, you know, of an institutional investor, or VC, whatever, do I care yet about how this startup is going to make money, or am I more concerned about does the technology work and might it have a use case in terms of adoption?
My feeling is that it's better, again, it's better to focus on what the use case, do you believe in this use case LLMs make sense, and what is the potential advantage that the startups has over others? Is it something AI related, meaning they, in this particular case, it requires custom or fine-tuned model, or the use case is, you know, everybody could take ChatGPT and use it, but then there is other things that could be very relevant. A deep understanding of the use case, potential integration with different systems and different processes, establishing channel, the right partnerships, etc. I think that's where it comes. And I would also say one additional thing, shifting gears to more to enterprises. I don't want to scare people too much, but I firmly believe that, and that's kind of also related to investment thesis. I firmly believe that within 3 to 5 years, any company that has sizable, let's say more than 1 million customer base, would need to make their internal knowledge bases accessible and served by large language models across all modalities and channels, emails, documents, chats, calls. Companies that will not embrace it, in my opinion, will face a risk of being disrupted by competitors. This will deliver much better customer experience at much lower, maybe 40 to 50% cost, leveraging generative AI and large language models. I mean, my slogan to companies in almost every vertical that has big customer service or customer interaction component, that you should be prepared to ChatGPT your competition, or your competition will ChatGPT you. And that's, to me, and both threat, but also an opportunity for companies that are smart and nimble enough to do it themselves, but also for startups that could offer it to many, many verticals where they did not focus on cutting-edge technology or didn't focus on cutting-edge AI. And those companies could fill an important role, an important gap for some of those industries.
Can you speak to some of the risks with AI within the enterprise space anyway? And I guess I mm-hmm. think about privacy, security, maybe a certain kind of bias within the data, looking at, you know, the efficacy of the models, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, great. So first of all, I think we will, on private security, it's very critical for many industries. And I think that, in my opinion, will be a big area of focus for cloud providers, because like both Microsoft and Google are offering those large language models in enterprise settings through their own cloud offering. And that's great, because you could basically get access to those models. It could be done in a very privacy-centric way, be it on cloud, or maybe on-premise. I think it will be much more on cloud than on-premise. But, you know, with certain SLAs and certain terms and conditions, that's very specific. So I think that's one angle that is very important. As I mentioned, integration into different systems within the enterprise in a privacy-centric way could be a great use case both for startups and for cloud providers. So that's on that level. Back to your point about inaccuracies or biases of offensive content, that's kind of to some extent why I encourage investors and enterprises initially to focus on use cases that are not like, I'm a big believer on augmenting human skills and not at replacing humans. So I generally advocate much more about the use cases where it's the use case of what I call, you know, you focus on fluency and you basically focus on use case where you could rely more on human labeling correction at scale, meaning you start a draft or you provide a suggested response to a customer service agent, to sales agent, etc., as a draft email, draft chat, draft document, because then you could deal with a lot of those things proactively, as opposed to, you know, in, let's say, Google search example, it's impractical to put a person to validate every answer. And if the answer is inaccurate or the answer is offensive, it's a big problem. So that's why I encourage everyone to look at that in a much more practical manner and focus on use cases where human could still check for accuracy, check for bias, etc., and correct it before, you know, using it, automating it, or sending it.
Within the corporate use case, are there any concerns, I guess, as it relates to corporate ethics, or is that really not a concern as we move forward? Like I'm thinking about in healthcare, perhaps, you know, more anything mm-hmm. else, but maybe that's more linked to privacy than anything else. If your privacy is buttoned up, probably, you know, you're not going to get into sort of any ethical issues.
Yeah, that's my feeling, that we should first focus on privacy, appropriate access controls, etc. That my hope, you know, cloud providers, and I know both Microsoft and Google are offering or working hard to offer it, that could be enterprise-grade access to those large language models that, you know, maintains privacy, security, access controls, etc. So I think that's where the focus should be.
Yeah. And I know that we really want to keep this conversation within, you know, the world of enterprise, you know, and business. But what are you seeing, you know, in terms of the developments that are coming up around the bend, whether it be in the enterprise world or not, relative to AI? Like, what are you seeing that perhaps isn't being even covered in the press yet? Like, what's some crazy use case that you've been hearing about, you know, that could be right around the corner that none of us are even reading about or hearing about?
Well, I actually, you know, since I'm a huge fan of large language models, because I was working with them for a lot of times. But I'm also encourage people to be very practical, because, you know, I worked on it for a long time. I'm also practical what it can do. Now, and in 2 to 3 years, I would actually encourage people. There is a lot of excitement and hype, and every day people are trying use cases, but we still need to see use cases that will get a lot of scale. I actually believe this technology is so amazing that we need to take this time and really be disciplined on understanding the enterprise use case and adapting it to enterprise use case. That's why, I mean, I'm trying to offer much more practical framework that basically say, here's what LLMs is very strong, and here's where LLMs is less strong. Let's focus on use cases that will deliver significant productivity gains and significant customer service experiences. Let's not go and start thinking about, you know, tomorrow we'll all AI will, you know, land on the moon, right? So I think we need to make sure that we are practical and encourage people to understand it's very exciting, but it's still a lot of nuances, a lot of complexities to implement this technology at scale. There are still a lot of things to figure out, and I would encourage a lot of people to focus on that.
Yeah, that makes good sense, to keep it practical and pragmatic, which I think in the business world you're sort of forced to do because you're dealing with budgets. If you're publicly traded company, you know, you're dealing with analysts, you know, on Wall Street. So, you know, as these publicly traded larger companies are rolling out their plans, you know, and their thesis around AI, you know, they're going to be buttoned up with their messaging, and, you know, they're going to try to figure out how it impacts the bottom line, I think, in a positive way, whether that be revenue or whether it just be cost savings or maybe a little of both, you know, because ultimately you can be efficient, but you want to be effective. There's really a big difference, you know, it's between efficiency and effectiveness.
Yes, absolutely. I always tell my team there is a difference between my example of being efficient and effective. Efficient is running like crazy, 120 miles an hour. Effective is also running in the right direction. I wanted to repeat what I said. Like, I really believe, and people should really embrace it. I really believe that on the most practical areas of, let's say, customer-facing interactions or coding or education, but specifically in customer-facing interactions, within 3 to 5 years, any company that has a sizable customer base, they really need to think how they make their internal data, internal knowledge base accessible and served by large language models across all channels. Because if they don't do that, they will suddenly discover there is a competitor who is doing it, either newcomer or existing competitor who was more nimble and smart, who is now deliver much better experience, which could be means, you know, more revenue at much lower. I mean, I would totally see it 40 to 50% cost reduction if you leverage general AI and large language models. That's huge for many verticals. And you see how market reacts to Chegg that basically got disrupted, or at least saying that disrupted by ChatGPT, like 50% drop, right? So yeah. I really believe it should be, you know, prepare to ChatGPT your competition, or before your competition ChatGPT you.
Right. No, it's absolutely huge. And the use cases go on and on. Like, we didn't even chat about, you know, the idea like of automation within the manufacturing industry, you know, I mean, there's, you know, and the supply chain space, there's so much there. And, you know, how are the transactions occurring? Will it be on blockchain, right? Like there's so many other factors.
Ton of stuff. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I would also, please remember also generative AI is just a subset of AI. So a lot of use cases to mention, we still continue steady progression on AI that is not necessarily generative AI, that doesn't require, you know, human level output in the sense of how you talk and how you, that's where a lot of excitement today. If you ask me, the biggest misconception today that a lot of excitement is about fluency, how suddenly machines start speaking like human, which is, again, it's amazing technological achievement, but people tend to, because it's not very human behavior to be, as I said, to speak like a very eloquent adult that has a conscience of 7-year-old, I think people tend to forget there are still a lot of challenges, especially on the accuracy side. And that's why I encourage people to be practical, both on their processes, on the use cases, and application of this technology.
So I guess we're coming to the top of the hour. Thank you so much for the chat. And the chat is the ChatGPT chat. This is actually us. This is the two of us. We are not bots. Do you have any closing thoughts to kind of sum up what we've been chatting about?
Yes, I think, as I say, we are living in amazing, exciting, but also to some people, might be rapidly changing and scary period of human history, because we literally have a new incarnation of this disruptive technology that will impact every aspect of our life, right? As I said, I'm considering myself lucky to embrace it. And, you know, I also hope that some of my talks and my framework on how to think about and how prioritize generative AI use cases will be helpful to many investors and enterprises as they embark on this amazing journey.
And it is an amazing journey. I mean, look, the you know, this may be the first time in decades that we will see real innovation from like boring corporate large companies, like like, not to call out a, let's say, Cargill, you know, or somebody like that, or like Kraft yeah. Heinz or something, but like, you know, we might see some significant massive innovation from some of these big companies, let alone all the startups, you know, that are going to get the funding.
Absolutely.
You know, and the fact is, I mean, I wonder if like we're going to be coming into a stage where you're better off in the corporate space in terms of innovation with AI, because I just don't know if you're one of a zillion startups trying to raise money around a particular use case of AI. I mean, number one, you really need the resources, you know, to get any kind of company off the ground, even if it's, you know, an AI based company, right? Like, you need the you need the manpower, you need the money. And just imagine sitting in the shoes of a VC, which I know that you're at a fund now, or at least one of your activities. I mean, imagine sitting in the seat of a VC and trying to make sense of all this noise. Like, where's the signal versus the noise? So anyway, that's, you know,
absolutely
for another conversation. But
it's always very fascinating. But you know, a lot of companies, amazing companies, were created during big technological shifts, and obviously, a lot of VCs made a lot of good money, and that's one of the things I'm hoping to help my own firm Scale VC do.
Well, and we should chat about Scale VC and what they're doing on our next round. But I really appreciate your time, Barak.
Perfect. Thanks for having me.